Good morning. And it is a good morning. Thank you, each of you, in the leadership of our service. And welcome, Brent and Alex, as for the first time you led us in worship. Well, we are in the midst, at the very end of a particular series on worship. God is in the house. And while Brian is sweetly sitting in Palm Springs, he asked me, Jim, it's you who has to preach this particular message because you're all about mission. Well, it's sort of true because Brian is more about worship and taking care of all those details, and I'm more preoccupied with mission. And so one of the things we want to talk about today is, how do these things work? I mean, if you ask somebody about what is Pacific and what two things might characterize Pacific or what makes us the busiest, and if you were to boil it down to two things, it would probably be worship and mission. Those two things sort of shape what we do. And, you know, last night we had over 300 people, I think up to 300 people. Oh, Matt will exaggerate more than me. But you know, who came out because of the mission of the kitchen that feeds those who are in need. And over $32,000 was raised as people, you know, collected the offerings from so many people around British Columbia, families and friends and so on. I mean, I get jazzed about that. Jazzed because only of the 300 were 10% of our own people, I would say. That somehow the reach of the church has stepped into the community where people like the Chamber and people out of the Rotary Club and people out of the different associations are coming because they totally buy into what the church is doing in the world. I don't know. I don't know if you get excited about that, but I sure do. I sure do. Particularly when people begin to rub shoulders with those who are doing it for the sake of the gospel. I remember sitting at a chamber luncheon, and it was one of these networking times, and we had to meet as many people as we could in about 40 minutes, and with only 2 minutes a person at a time, or maybe 4 minutes. And so I was going around doing my little thing and chatting up about the church and about the mission, because that's what I get passionate about. But this other lady, she was talking. She was a funeral director. And in town, at Kearney's funeral services. And she goes, Jim, I got to thank you. I go, why? She goes, remember I did the funeral for that young woman, Krista? I go, yeah, I remember that. She goes, you know that blog she wrote? I read that almost every week. Still. And when families come to deal with the funeral arrangements for loved ones that are facing death, you know what I do? I hand over those leftover cards that Krista gave me, and they read the blog. I get jazzed about that. That you know, Krista, who though as a young woman lost her life to cancer, nevertheless lived in mission for the sake of the world. So I get jazzed about that. And Brian, when you sit down with him, he gets jazzed about what? Worship. And what we do here on Sunday mornings. And so you got two people arguing every Tuesday about what's more important. No, we are in fact saying, no, this is two parts of the reality of what it means to be the church. And so when I feel like I'm losing, I hire Matt. And when Brian thinks he's losing, he hires Jeff. You know, it's... So we build our cases. But tell me this. Can you separate worship and mission? Can you? I mean, we need to think about this because, in fact, though we might say they belong together, sometimes we, in our practice, tend to take them apart. John Piper, and I don't quote him often, but he says this good thing. He says, we do mission because we do not worship. That the primary purpose of the church is to encourage the whole world to come to worship the true God. And that the ultimate purpose, when all things are concluded anyways, as we read from scriptures in the book of Revelations, that all peoples will worship him. And the purpose and the task of the church is to what? Is to invite people into the worship of God on a regular basis. So in fact, mission is driven by worship. The recognition that all people, if they want to become truly whole human beings in this world, can only find their wholeness, as was prayed in our prayer this morning, when they come to know God and are reconciled to him and find their identity in the Creator who has made them. And so mission and vision come together. In fact, when the Apostle Paul is writing to his friends, the church congregation there in Romans, he opens up his letter and ends his letter by describing his purpose. His purpose is this: I preach the gospel so that what? All the Gentiles might come to the obedience that comes from faith. He wants people just to come to the reality of who God is and live their life for the sake of God, but live in a new way that even makes more sense for them and for others in the world. So you can see, and maybe I'm overstating the case here, like I already agree with you, Jim, stop talking and move on. But mission and worship go hand in hand. They go hand in hand. Perhaps some metaphors really will help us sort of even deepen our appreciation of how worship and mission are so tightly connected, because we could theologize and talk about this a lot, but we will through Psalm 96, but there's a few great metaphors that help us sort of get our heads around the connection. And I draw two of these from Ruth A. Myers in her book, Missional Worship and Worshipful Mission. I didn't read it, but I did read a cheat notes on it. And she offered two metaphors. I can't do everything. And can't read every book in the world. But she offers two great metaphors. And one is this. And there's a picture of this. It's a picture of a Mobius strip. Anybody know what a Mobius strip is? Oh, yeah, Google it. But anyways, here's a picture of it. It's you know, if you were to walk along one of the edges, you would be able to walk the whole, both sides without ever crossing over. So think about that. So if an ant was walking, it would never cross over the edge, and yet it would walk both sides. This is sort of the cool thing about the Mobius strip. But it does provide a decent image about worship. Worship and mission are so connected that you could be moving in mission and you don't know when you're crossing over into worship. And as you're worshiping, you don't know when you're crossing over into mission. They're so intimately connected, is the point. Here's another image. You might like this one. The spinning top. Imagine worship being the center of the spinning top. The place where heaven and earth meets. And it's moving, you know, and it's moving in the center, and it needs to be in the center. But yet, you can't take a nail and spin it and that it will keep on going. No, you need the bulk of what? Mission. For the spinning top to really spin, both worship and mission are required. Or here, how about this particular image? Worship and mission can be understood like a heart and the cardiovascular system, where worship is like the heart pumping the nutrients and the life through the arteries and the veins that bring the blood back. And there's this dynamic relationship between the mission and the life of the church and the very heart. In fact, it's even the mission that helps the heart survive. And so this connection between worship and mission. I'm sure there's other great metaphors, but this connection between worship and mission, I think, is critical for us to understand. And as we, you know, make our way to the end of this message, the profound impacts of that for us. So we read Psalm 96. It's perhaps the most missionary of all the psalms you can find of the 150 psalms in the Bible. And here we see in this psalm an amazing connection between worship and mission. And so let's just unpack that text a little bit here. This psalm is a great, great song. And six times, it's a typically modeled a psalm because it calls people to worship. And six times in the first three verses, it says, sing to the Lord, sing a new song. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name, praise his name, proclaim his salvation day after day, declare. It's summoning the people of God. No, more than that. It's summoning all of earth into worship of the great God. And every call to worship out of the Psalms always comes with some power-packed reasons about why you should worship. And so we see that in verses 4 to 6. Why should you worship God? Well, we sang some of this stuff already in some of our songs, but again, this psalm, for great is the Lord. He's great, and he's most worthy of praise. He is to be feared above all gods. Whatever God you can imagine, God is greater than that. For all the gods of the nations, and here's a scandal of biblical belief and Christianity, is that all the gods of the nations are idols. They're meaningless. They're empty. But the Lord has made the heavens. He's the one who makes the heavens and the earth. He's really in charge. And splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and glory are in his sanctuary. And so the psalm is just calling people forth into the place of worship right in the midst of the temple courts. Here even today, God is summoning you, the whole world, all of creation, into worship because God is in the house. Walter Brueggemann, one of my favorite Old Testament commentators, he describes this psalm as a psalm of orientation. We use this language often when we're talking about the different psalms, and this particular psalm is a psalm of orientation, in contrast to a psalm of disorientation. Psalms of disorientation, you would recognize them, like the lament of Psalm 13, which is a despairing, depressing psalm that voices out to God their sense of lostness and their sense of being in chaos. And they call out to God to act graciously or to overcome the enemy, to lift me out of the pit. Those would be psalms of disorientation. But this particular psalm, Psalm 96, is a psalm of orientation. It's like God showed up. He has lifted me out of the pit. Amazing. He's changed what's our nation. He's doing good things. And all of a sudden, there's new hope. And in this psalm, there is that new sense of orientation. The celebration of something new that has happened on earth. It's about God breaking forth in power and in majesty on the earth. And so they can declare, you know, strength and power are in his sanctuary. Now, more than likely, this psalm was written for the coronation of a king. And so prior to having a king, everybody's sort of wondering, what is God up to? But now a king has been established on the throne, and this particular song is probably written for the sake of this coronation and saying, and maybe it's King David, maybe it's Solomon. We're not exactly sure who this was written on behalf of. But for Israel, the enthronement of a new earthly king was a sign of God's faithfulness upon the nation of Israel. God was showing up. In fact, the key verse in all of this psalm is in verse 10, where out of this sense of celebration, they declare, the Lord reigns. God is in charge. Look what's happening. God has saved us. God is making something happen. And in the very moment of their worship, they are just being enthused by the reality of God at work amongst them and in them. And really, when you think about that, isn't that what worship is all about? It's coming to the experience, the encounter of what God is doing. See, worship, you see, what we do here on Sunday to Sunday is not play acting. We're not just, oh, let's tell a few stories and hope you learn a bit and a little bit of this and a little bit of that, a little challenge here, just a little bit of moral persuasion to live a little bit better and, you know, shake a few hands, you know, find somebody to have coffee with. No. In the very context of worship, this liturgical experience where the people of God work together, and you can see that in our church we value the plurality of people. People who pray, people who sing, people who greet, people who usher, people who pray. That this is the work of the people and we're experiencing the reality of God, of heaven, touching down in this. And he touches down in many, many ways throughout the week. But particularly on Sunday, we're saying as the people gather, God is doing something right now. God is in the house. We're not play acting. And in fact, as Brueggemann would say, what's happening in liturgy is the evoking of an alternative reality that comes into play every time we meet in worship. In fact, what's happening in worship through the preaching and the teaching and all that kind of stuff too, is as we sing songs and is we're bringing the past stories of Scripture, right? We're remembering what God has accomplished, particularly through Jesus Christ, for our sakes and for the sake of the world. But at the same time, you know, not only are we drawn from the past, but we're also looking to the future, seeing what God will in fact do. And so even in this psalm, as they're worshiping, it's like for them right there at that moment, momentarily, everything is being accomplished right now, even the future. So that's why the psalm can end. Everybody, praise all of creation. You birds, sing. You fish in the sea, sing. Right in the very moment, they're saying, God is at work. The future is here. We are now filled with new hope. And there's a power in worship. You know it. You've seen it. You've felt it. You know that the temperature, even this morning, the temperature just sort of rose as we sang the songs and there was a sense of God's at work. Well, what's happening? The past and the future are being brought together in a moment. In this worship, it's think about booster cables. You know, you got a dead battery. You got a dead battery. What do? You got booster cables. You find your neighbors, you got booster cables? I need to charge up my dead battery. So what do? They take the booster cables. There's a positive and a negative, a past and a future. And we come into this place, and we're a bit tired. We're a bit maybe discouraged, hungry, need healing. Oh, what do we? Our battery's a little bit fatigued. What do? We're basically in worship. We're saying connect to God and all that He's done. Connect to God and all that He's doing, and boom, new energy. Because worship is a transforming experience. God is on a mission, right in worship. So let the heavens rejoice, let the earth be glad. Let the fields be jubilant. Let all the trees of the forest sing for joy. Let all creation rejoice. I mean, this is scandalous. Telling the world who to worship. And saying to them, all of their gods are as nothing to God. I mean, we were singing boldly the songs. Our God is great. Our God is the one who heals. Our God is the one who delivers. I mean, in a world modern, secular like ours, that's a pretty strong, bold statement. And so this song. There's Israel, little puny Israel, small little nation, declaring to the whole of the world, their God reigns. So what do we take from that? What do we learn about worship and mission? Well, the psalm assumes two things that the rest of the Bible also assumes. First is this. Every single human being is a worshiper. If you're human, you're a worshiper. The question is, who do you worship? Some people might say, well, I don't feel that religious, or I don't need to show up to church, or whatever, whatever. But the psalmists, the whole of the Bible, is saying every single person is a worshiper. They desire to pursue what is meaningful and important. Two, a second thing of what we learn from this passage and about worship and mission is this, that worship is a public event. What we're doing here is not members only. I mean, I know we have all kinds of criticisms for big institutions and stuff like that. But, you know, I sort of like what's that guy did with the Crystal Cathedral thing. I mean, it was sort of a cool idea, wasn't it? He created a worship center which the world could look into and they could look out of. I've never been there. Who has been there? Is that sort of what it's like? You're in this glass box. Nobody likes being in a glass box. But that's what worship is. It's a glass box. So the world can see and you can invite the world into. Worship is a public event. As it was for Israel, so it is for the church. That's why so many Christians at times take great risks in societies which want to oppress Christians. They will still boldly declare the praises of God. Why? Because it's a public event. And when you praise God, you are confronting the realities of thinking and society that are against God and against humanity and against creation. And you're declaring there is something better and it's our God. And so, it's a public event. All people are worshipers. All people are invited in. You know, God did not ask Solomon to build a temple just to highlight the success of Israel. Build a temple just to show off to the people that you guys got it all together. In fact, when Solomon prayed his prayer of dedication of this temple, he prays for who, among some other things? He prays for the foreigner. As for the foreigner who does not belong to your people Israel, God, but has come from a distant land because of your great name and your mighty hand and your outstretched arm, people who are seeing who you are, and when they come and pray toward this temple, God, hear them. Hear them. Hear them from heaven. Hear them from your dwelling place. And do whatever they ask so that they may know your name and fear you and do as your own people Israel and may they and that they may know that this house that I have built bears your name. I mean, Israel understood when it was at its best that it was all about God's work in the world. Even some synagogues, if a little bit of history here, but in between the New Testamental period, in the the intertestamental period, you know, the 400 years after the old and before the new, when the Jewish people were building synagogues, many of them saw that as a missional engagement to the world, to declare the praises of their God to Roman society. So what does this mean for us? If mission and worship are together, well, now I was just talking to Bill Van Giemen in the back here. And, you know, we're a small, medium church in Cloverdale comparatively to many other churches. I was talking to him about, you know, last night and the many different things we're going through. And he said, man, sometimes I feel like we're so stretched out. Like this church is just packing out in so many different ways, whether it's the shuttle or the food program or the hampers, and the list can go on. And it's just a church where so much happens. And I'm thinking, well, that's partly because we are taking God seriously when we show up here on Sundays. And we seek to live out in such a way that we can be the people of God, not here in just this moment, but also the people of God out there, so that we spin out in life to the world. And so we're talking about worship. How do we shape our worship here at Pacific in such a way that it does equip us? Not just to encounter God and then go home and quietly, you know, watch and binge on Netflix because we don't know what to do, but how do we shape worship so that, in fact, it transforms the way we live? How does that happen? Now, some people think that worship happens, you know, by changing people's minds, which will then alter their hearts, and then they do an act, something. So, and often churches shape that way. We're going to preach it good to you. You're going to be compelled. You're going to sense the warmth of the Spirit working in your life, and then all of a sudden you're going to be activated for new ways of living. And that's true. It's worked. It works. We do that in schools. We do that in other settings. But it's also true that the way we use our hands can also shape our hearts and begin to reformat our minds. That it's a both and. The reality for me, here's a good illustration. One of the concerns Monica has about my life is a big concern, probably bigger than I imagine. So she says, Jim, how often do you need to be on your smartphone? Well, Monica, I read the newspapers, I do my emails, I do my phone. Everything's on there, like everything. My Bible's on there too. But she says, Jim, every time you're on there, you're looking down. You're not looking at us. So this is one of her big concerns that I've been sort of resistant on, because it's everything, Monica. This is how I function. So let's take that concern. If I continue to be preoccupied, how does that little device begin, just the practice of that, begin to change my heart and begin to change the way I think? You could already probably sense a little bit of a process going on there. In fact, what we do from week to week can really begin to change who we are. So in church, it's not just hearing stuff, but it's also doing stuff that begins to shape what we do. Here's an example. You know, if you've been here, that we do communion every week. Just one of our practices. And when we invite you to come forward, we invite you to do what? We invite you to hold out your hand. Just that action is hugely life-changing. Why? Because we're encouraging people not to come to the table just to take. Okay, why? Because we live in a world that takes. Grabbing. Getting the most. And here we come into this place and we just invite you to receive and to be granted a gift from our God. And so not only do we expect you to be changed missionally by the preaching and the teaching, but also by what we do and how we live. In fact, the whole table is a practice that we do every week because we want this table to shape the way we live our lives. And so we invite you to think about, how do you extend this table into your friendships? How do you extend this table into your neighborhood? How do you extend this table into your workplace? When we think about the people that we feed, it's simply this. All we're doing on Monday nights and Wednesday nights and Friday nights is taking this table, figuratively, picking it up, taking it over to the next room, and saying, people, enjoy the generosity of God. That's all we're doing. The table in our worship is shaping our life missionally. And yet the challenge of that mission drives us back to worship. So our worship needs to be missional. So let me, before we end, just walk through some of the things that we do along with this table. I mean, think about it. The call to worship. What is the call to worship about? Is it just a howdy-doody time? Hello, isn't this a nice day? So glad to see you. No. At a certain point, after Jeff sort of warmed us up a little bit, Brent then took a text of God speaking to us, summoning you. Now think about how powerful that is. I mean, it's Brent, but it's now Brent in the context of worship who's speaking the words of God to us. All you who are thirsty, come. All you who are hungry, come. There's food at the table. Come. And it's God calling you. I mean, this whole call to worship, it's scandalous. I know what it's like because really your liturgical practice probably started last night when you're thinking, should I go to church tomorrow? I'm not sure if I'm feeling all that well. Do I have time for this? There's other things I could be doing. But God is calling you. You probably woke up this morning and for some of you it was a bit of a hassle. And yet you took the time to get here. God is summoning you. And as you're coming, you're watching people who are going for a jog. People going to McDonald's. People going to their sports games. God has called you out of the nations of the world to gather here in this moment, in this place, to do what? To meet God. This call to worship describes exactly who we are as people called. And consider the songs that we sung. We use songs in many different ways. But you know, when we get into worship, really the reality is we're encountering God, and you know what? If you're like me, this is way over our heads, really. We're meeting God, the Holy One in His sanctuary, and coming is like, you know, I can review my week pretty good, and I'm sure I didn't measure up. And we come, even that first song that we sung, it was asking God to come, even despite ourselves. That we were welcoming Him, opening up our heart to Him, and inviting Him to do His work amongst us. And there was a sense, even through the worship, that we were declaring beliefs. Our God is a lion. He roars. He fights our battles. He's a lamb. Every knee will bow to the lion and to the lamb. Pretty bold songs. Retelling the story of the gospel and at the same time setting us in that very moment where we're bringing past and future together in a moment where we need transformation, and God shows up. And these songs are powerful, and we're going to sing some more yet. But even think of the greeting. Why do we greet? Just to pass the time? Or is it an indication of the community that we are part of? Brothers and sisters, we're connected. I don't know you, but because you're a brother or a sister, I'm going to show you the generosity of love and trust, because God is forming us into a family, into a community. I mean, the greeting is not just, you know, whatever. It is, in fact, an indication of fellowship. Our giving, where we give of our offerings and we pass this plate, it indicates our desire to serve and to love in whatever ways. When we do a child dedication or a baptism, it's us participating with one person, but also remembering what we have decided to follow this God. And through even baptism, every time somebody gets baptized, I tingle, because I remember what God has accomplished through Jesus Christ, what he's accomplished in the world, and what he's doing here right at the moment. And of course, the prayers of the people, where we grieve, where we lament, and where we remember and call forth God to act in particular places and situations. And then, of course, the word and the preaching, the table, and the benediction. Worship is all about mission, reshaping you. I think, you know, as I think about what worship and mission is all about, I wonder if we need to, today, in our community of faith, where we're there, we've lost our understanding of what is happening from Sunday to Sunday. Where I see more and more people trading off Sundays for other things that are important. Saying, you know, well, I wasn't able to capture worship here together with God's people this morning, but I'm sure I can pick it up on the radio as I drive to work. Perhaps I'll take a hike. Now, all these places, we do encounter God, no doubt about it. But I wonder if the practices of our lives have diminished our sense of what God is really up to when we concentrate time together as a community, rehearsing and recounting the stories of the gospel and allowing God to move. I wonder if we've separated what God does with us on Sundays and separate from the missions that we keep ourselves busy with. And when we do that we can be challenged as the Church of Ephesus was challenged. You have lost your first love. And as Jesus says to the Church of Ephesus, if you do not change, I will come and take my lampstand away. I am a person who I'd rather be running and racing and doing most of my life. That's why I'm probably more executive-like than preaching-like. I'm busy in mission, seeing good things happen. And when Jeff talks about encounters with God, I'm going, that's great, but what's next? And so for me, I have to be pulled by Jeff into the encounter with God. And in that my encounter with God, I know it's what pushes me into life. And to do the things that we as a church do in terms of mission, we need a place of radical worship. And we need a radical people who boldly sing these songs and radically stretch out their hearts and boldly recognize that God is in the house and respond to him. So Jesus is here. He is in the house. He's been through this service. And now he's going to invite you to the table. He has said over and over to you this morning, I love you. I have accomplished great things for you. I'm your healer, your restorer. Come and eat my body. Drink my blood. And you will find life. And so we believe. Even as you come and eat and drink, you are encountering God, the very person of Jesus Christ. This is not play acting. So Jesus invites you to come, to worship him in the coming, in the receiving, in the eating, in the drinking, and of your going. So on the night when Jesus was betrayed, he did take this bread. He said to his disciples, eat this and remember me. And after the meal, he took the cup and he said, This is my blood which has been poured out for you. Drink it in remembrance of me, for it is for the forgiveness of your sins and for the sins of many. Drink it and remember. So I invite you to come to the table. We're going to have three stations up here as we normally do. We'll come from the back to the front, and if in your heart you want to worship Jesus Christ, who we have worshiped through this whole service, come and eat. And as they come, I invite you to pray this prayer. Father in heaven, we come to this table and we acknowledge that we need you. And so as we eat of this bread and drink from this cup, we want to be transformed by you. Reveal your splendor and your glory through this table and in our worship, so that we might be the kind of people in this world that declare your praises. This we ask. In Jesus' name, amen.